Good evening. Welcome to the Solari Report. Today is Thursday, June 14th, 2012. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Tonight, the Precious Metals Market Report with Franklin Sanders. We'll be joined by my partner at Sealane Advisory, Chuck Gibson. He's our special guest tonight to help us talk about hedging your precious metals. We've gotten lots of questions. We want to talk about the various options and the pros and cons of using hedging techniques. It's been an exciting time at Solari. Last week, most of the members of our team came into Tennessee for an all-hands-on-deck meeting, the results of which we're very excited about what's cooking for the Solari Report over the next few months. One of the many particulars is that John Rappaport has agreed to provide us with a monthly interview exclusive. We'll be publishing that starting in the last week of next month and the last week of every month from there on out. More on that when John joins us next week for the Solari Report. We'll be doing the best books for the 21st century. It's been a big question from the subscribers, and so we hope you really enjoy that. Next Saturday, June 30th, we're having lunch in the Cincinnati area for subscribers. If you'd like to join us, please log into the blog and sign up. And yes, of course, we'd be delighted for you to bring a guest. Our theme tonight is financial saltwater taffy. I put up a great quote from George Roche on this week's blog post. It says, what the gods would destroy first, they will subsidize. And sure enough, we're watching worldwide a world choking on government debt and spending that has created a world that keeps slowing down as each new round of new capital and bailouts is spent in a manner that can't produce real returns or is designed to destroy them. And part of what's happening is the market-based incentives and communications are getting stuck in the financial saltwater taffy of more government debt, more government fiat currency, and ever more rules, regulation, and political management. It's a reminder of one of my favorite quotes from Franklin when he says, all government money comes with a sock in the jaw. There's plenty of news, and we've posted lots on the blog this week. Spain, of course, grappling with bailouts. The big news, of course, is Greek elections coming up this weekend. All sorts of rumors, including of potential coordinated central bank actions. But it's going to make for a very interesting Sunday here. Iceland sentences bank executives responsible for the banking collapse to prison terms, something that hasn't happened in a lot of places. A place to really watch is the Middle East. We're coming up onto a July 1st date for a new round of particularly the EU sanctions on Iran, and that's a very big headache for Japan, South Korea, China, and India, who are dependent on Iran's oil exports. They buy about two-thirds. We'll post an article tomorrow on the blog. Japan is set to pass a bill to ensure oil imports to keep it going. It's an important situation to watch. Remember, Japan came into World War II because we cut off their oil. And so there are very sensitive issues going on in the Middle East now. In Asia, you kind of wonder what this is about. The Chinese have offered 1.3 billion pounds for the London Metal Exchange. Hard to believe the City of London would really let them buy and control it. But I asked Franklin to take a look at that, and hopefully he'll have a comment this evening. In the U.S. economy, the natural gas shift continues. If you haven't listened to the last interview I did with Jim Norman, I would strongly recommend it to you. One of the things Jim said is that 40% of U.S. manufacturing costs come from energy. It's a higher component of their costs than labor. And that's why this tremendous drop in natural gas prices, in part coming from new fracking technology, is having such a profound effect. I put up an article in the blog. I just wanted to read a few things to you from it. The fuel that powered the U.S. from the Industrial Revolution into the iPhone era is being pushed aside. They're referring to coal. As utilities switch to cleaner, cheaper alternatives, the share of U.S. electricity that comes from coal is forecast to fall below 40% for the year, the lowest level since the government began collecting this data in 1949. 4 years ago, it was 50%. Utilities are aggressively ditching coal in favor of natural gas, which has become cheaper as supplies grow, and on and on. I also continue to post articles and videos on robotics. One today on a robotic sewing machine that claims textiles could return in significant volume from China to the U.S. another, believe it or not, on a pizza machine that will make a pizza to order, like a vending machine from Fresh Ingredients. There's a video of it. These technologies can have a very dramatic impact, including rising unemployment significantly. So we really want to keep an eye on them. I'll talk more about it in the wrap-up. Finally, a very interesting post from Forbes called Why Apple is Afraid of Bitcoin on Apple and the Competition over Digital Wallets, which I think is also something to keep an eye on. There was a pretty face on the financial markets this week. You kind of wonder what all the backdoor deals was. Jamie Dimon testifies before the Senate hearing on the J.P. Morgan Chase financial loss, and everybody acted like everything was hunky-dory. Dimon insisting that it wasn't a speculative position, but that the portfolio morphed. Kind of sounds like what happens when the hedge no longer works. S&P reaffirms AAA plus Treasury rating, confident that Congress will avoid a fiscal cliff after the election. It's very interesting to know how they anticipate that's going to happen. In local government and states, the North Dakota voters overwhelmingly rejected a constitutional amendment that would have made it the first state without property taxes, with 63% of the precincts reporting on the last article I read. The measure was rejected by 78% to 22%. One of the issues was how the governments, local governments, would replace the $810 million, almost $1 billion in revenues from the property taxes. North Dakota is a state with a, relative to anyone else in the United States, or relative to most states, has a very strong economy thanks to agriculture and oil. But it's a reminder, a very sharp reminder, that the U.S. population is highly dependent on government spending and traditionally very much in favor of it. That's how we got to an economy that is so dependent on government spending. An IRS Oversight Board annual report issued serious problems at the IRS and, interestingly enough, noted opposition to foreign financial reporting and what a strain it put on resources. Not a surprise, as we discussed at tax time and did our special report on the foreign financial reporting. It's very burdensome, very complex, particularly a nightmare for people who are living abroad. And that's not surprising at all that it's a real nightmare for the IRS as well. Federal Magistrate Stephen Smith wrote a paper I wanted to point out to you. I posted it last week, but I didn't talk about it last week. It's called Gag, Sealed, and Delivered, and it talks about the extent of the court orders for electronic surveillance. It's quite a chilling article, and it's worth reading because it's very rare for a federal magistrate to write something like this, and it really speaks to how serious the problem has become. Another very interesting piece worth noting in the under sort of the U.S. economy, Carville and his firm, Jim Carville, wrote a memo. It's up in Money and Markets, and it was really a memo written to the Democratic Party trying to persuade them to change how they approach the election in terms of how they treat the economy. Carville was the one who came up with the expression, "It's the economy, stupid." But it has some very interesting comments on the perceptions of the candidate, of the American people regarding the candidates. In media, the Times Picayune in New Orleans lays off almost 200 people, half their news staff, and is going to 3-day-a-week paper. More announcements of major layoffs and changes in Alabama paper. That's sort of a symptom of what's happening globally as we see the print media really struggling in the face of more and more things going digital, going on the internet, going through the smartphones. Fugmi Health, there's just fantastic news this week. The effort in California to get a referendum on the November ballot to require genetically modified foods to label their products has succeeded, and that is really a triumph. I can't tell you how pleased I am of all that. And in fact, one of our heroes for the week, we're going to have two this week, but one of our heroes is really a group. If you look at the extraordinary effort it took to get those signatures, all the volunteers, the grassroots activists, the farmers, and the leadership of the California effort are to be complimented. And this is an effort to, you know, if you go to Europe, you get labeling, but you don't hear. And if we can accomplish it in California, we can accomplish it in the United States. If we can accomplish it in the United States, we can accomplish it globally. And it could make an extraordinary difference to the preservation of a healthy food system. And in respect to complementing the leadership of that, I wanted to compliment a couple of people who've been noted as participating. One is the Lundberg Family Farm, the Strauss Family Creamery, which is, in fact, the first creamery in the country to be voluntarily certified as GMO-free, and Dr. Bonner Magic Soaps. There's just tremendous foodie resources out in California. In science and technology, I wanted to mention a few things. The worst idea of the week is the Gates Foundation, and this article is up on the blog. Check it out. The Gates Foundation is financing testing of galvanic bracelets. These are little bracelets that you put on children. They work like a lie detector. The children wear them during class, and they provide feedback to both administrators and teachers about how engaged the students are. If you can imagine anything as Orwellian as this, Diane Ravitch, one of the experts in the country on education, has blogged about it, and I posted that on the blog. She also posted about being thrown out of Brookings in a very sort of unceremonious way after being resoundingly critical of the Romney candidacy. And you wonder if Brookings Institution is being set up to engineer the Romney economic revolution, but that's a tangent. Take a look at the Gates article. It's very another reason to consider homeschooling. Another video that I posted was a fellow who had come back from vacation. He'd had a Volkswagen diesel car in Europe and had gotten, I guess, 70 miles per hour or better, and came back and realized he couldn't get such a car in the United States. The government wouldn't permit it, and was told by one of the dealers that the government would lose too much tax revenues. And it's just a reminder of how financial incentives can create very perverse incentives to really getting effective change. So we're all paying much more for our gas here because the government needs the revenue. The other hero I wanted to mention today was Dr. Jim McKinney, on E-Star on our team, put up an obituary for him. He was a remarkable Montana healer. I know that Montana subscribers and certainly the Montana members of the Solaria team have often used him, as have I. He died this week. He's a person who healed and educated and touched hundreds of thousands of people's lives. Also wrote a beautiful book, In the Presence of Angels. You can read his obit up on the blog. He's an extraordinary example of how much good one man can do in this world, and just a reminder, an inspiration to all of us. Ask Catherine. We've got a couple of interesting questions. We had put up a request for the best graduation speech and got a comment. Someone said, the college professor said, quote, the only thing that will not change is that there is change. This has helped me move into the present after operating as if I'm in the past or future many times. And we also had several people note Michael Lewis's speech at Princeton, saying that success was largely as a result of luck, and resulting in much more comment and criticism than he ever dreamed a speech in Princeton would get. We also got an interesting question. I'll just read it to you, but I'll put it to Franklin when he joins us. Subscriber wrote, and I'm going to read the whole question. Can you comment tonight on the suspending trading this weekend for investors? It's a service, Owanda, which is an internet forex trading. And here's the announcement that they sent. It was to an investment club. Subject, interesting mail from Owanda. Extreme market volatility expected around time of Greek elections. Due to the extreme volatility, some market analysts foresee could result in the coming days. Owanda FX trade will not accept any trading activity from 6 a.m. Eastern Standard Time until approximately 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Sunday, June 17, 2012. Owanda believes the convergence of major market event during off-market hours represents a potential trading risk and has taken this rare step to protect traders from excessive rate fluctuations. Please note that during this halt in trading, you can still access your account details, but no trading activity will be accepted. For this reason, Owanda strongly recommends that all traders consider minimizing currency exposures prior to the trading halt If you do intend to maintain open positions during this period, be aware that Awanda will hold exchange rates steady during the trading halt. However, when trading resumes, rates will immediately adjust to the current market rate, and it is possible that the updated rate could result in a margin closeout if the prices move significantly against your positions. Therefore, it is your responsibility to ensure you have adequate funds in your account to prevent a margin closeout. Awanda apologizes for any inconvenience this may cause. For more information, please contact a customer service representative. Best regards. So, sounds like more than a little nervousness about what could be coming up with Sunday. So, let's see if Franklin has joined us. Franklin, are you with us?
I'm sitting right here.
So last week you were in North Carolina and I was in Tennessee, and now I'm headed to North Carolina and you're in Tennessee.
Well, I sort of envy you because the eastern part of North Carolina around Asheville is just gorgeous.
It really is. I don't know if I ever told you this, but when we started our Solari Circle, we were meeting by bridge phone, and everyone knew me, but we didn't sort of know each other. So we decided to do a simulation. We said, okay, we're going to pretend we're a family of four. We have $1 million in cash, and we're homeless. And so the first thing we need to do is we need to determine what our budget is to buy a home, and we need to decide where on the planet we want to live. So we did a whole search and defined criteria of the best place to live. And as a result, we chose Asheville, North Carolina. And then one of the members of the circle ended up moving right outside of Asheville, North Carolina. So
one of the most wonderful things about it is that they have a very high standard of local craftsmanship. So in the building, there is a lot of beauty, and it's handmade beauty. I think of those fences, the kind of Adirondack style fences. That I don't know really what you call them, but they're made from limbs and branches that are not, you know, cut except at the end where they're fit together. So it's a wonderful place. It really is.
Okay, so the precious metals market report, silver and gold. We've had quite a month since we talked last month on last month's precious metals market report. So maybe if you could just start with an update on what's been happening.
Well, last month we talked on the 10th, I think, and the market turned on the 18th. And I am as sure as I can be that it did turn on the 18th. I mean, turned up. In other words, it completed a bottom and turned up. And I remember because it's the same day I left on my vacation. So, and it's done nothing since then, although the trading activity is very suspicious to me when you get these great big climbs one day and then these great big drops the next day. Your mind runs to, you know, the nice government men who don't really want gold to rise. Gold has come up off of that bottom and has made good strides, and now it needs to clear 1625, the area of 1625, 1630. Once it clears that area, then very quickly it ought to move for 1682, which is where the next big resistance is. But the fullness of time is here. Both gold and silver have had on that 18th of May date, had quite a bit of time to, based on their previous corrections, to complete a correction that is completed as far as the bottom is concerned. Now they do the second half of it, which is climb back up to the old peak. But I think you'll see that slowly across the summer. And if you get some kind of accident, like big trouble out of Greece this weekend, then you could see gold or silver spurt. But there was also no question in my mind. I just have to say this, looking at the markets today, the dollar fell. Now, that makes no sense at all. It fell 0.33%, and the dollar index, that is. Then, in advance of that Greek election, that makes no sense at all. Everybody's dumping dollars. They're not running to safety. I mean, that it just does make a bit of sense. But and gold and silver were both hit today very early in the day with very heavy selling, and just as almost as quickly as they went down, they drove right back up. So there's very great underlying strength in both gold and silver, but I think, you know, the central banks were all cranked up to make things look good before the Greek election, to drive the euro up and make things look good before the Greek elections. They also made noises out of their latest G20 summit in Los Cabos, Mexico. Do you ever wonder why they don't meet in Chula, Mississippi, or someplace like that? No, they always meet in Los Cabos, Mexico, or some neat place like that. Anyway, they're spending your money after all. But they made announcements that they all stood ready to loan more money. The British Exchequer Secretary made an announcement last. I've made a speech today that the British government, the Bank of England, was going to do much more to flood the country with money. The European central banks flooded the country with flooded their banking system since December with $1.25 trillion. They just bailed out the Spanish banks to the tune of $1.25 billion. So this is not, you know, there's no reason to expect silver and gold to go down. And the markets, judging from the stock market today, markets expect governments around the world to continue to inflate and to try more of the QE2 type inflationary injections. So everything looks good for silver and gold. The bottoms look like they're in. We also got, just checking at it from another direction, we got a high in the gold-silver ratio at 57.5, which puts a double top on that, which makes it look like that move has been completed, and usually that marks the end of a correction too. So everything looks like it's completed to me. You know, it looks like it's ready to go. Looks very good.
The stock, now, by the way, traditionally, what is summer usually, as a season, what is summer usually like for precious metals?
Oh, it's lousy. It's dead. And usually you get a seasonal low end of June, 1st of July. But, you know the value of looking at seasonals, right? You can set your calendar by them. That's about it. I mean, you know, there's no reason that the seasonals can't do the opposite of that. You don't expect that, but from about where we are, maybe another 3 weeks into the year, you expect them to turn up. Not fast, but the turning point is usually end of June, 1st of July. And then August, kind of early in August, they start really kind of edging up, and then September take off.
Right. Although I will say this year, if you look at the politics of the election, I can see lots of reasons why the central bankers would like to keep a ceiling on gold and silver. I really can. So
you wouldn't want to run for presidential reelection with you know, gold gaining a percent a day, or half a percent or a percent a day, and the dollar sinking. No.
Well, it'd be very interesting to discuss if a decision ever gets made that it's going to be Romney and not the sitting president. It'd be very interesting to see what that would mean for gold.
Well, initially, you know, he's viewed as, I hate this word, conservative. He's viewed as a conservative, and maybe he is compared to Obama. I don't know, but that's a distinction without a difference. He's a big spender. I mean, he's just the same old, you know, Republican,
right,
support corporations, big spender type. There's nothing different about him. So, that's all.
Did you hear the post I read from the subscriber about the firm that wasn't going to permit trading this Sunday?
Yes, and I live in a thin market, and by that I mean, you know, the physical gold and silver markets are fairly thin. That is, they're small and not terribly deeply capitalized. And what I see out of that announcement is somebody in the management looked at this weekend and said, you know, we're open when other people are not, and we're just as liable to get dumped on, you know, with thousands and thousands of trades that we have no counterparty for, and we're just not going to do it. So, I mean, from a management standpoint, it was a wise thing to do. People think that they can trade 24 hours a day, and they don't understand that the person who manages, who they're trading with, has to have a counterparty to lay off those trades. If everybody comes in and wants to sell dollars, for example, who's going to take the other side of that trade? Somebody has to buy them.
So, right. Well, we're getting into a world where everything is very discontinuous, and so normal market operations can't function in the way that we could expect them 2 years ago. We just we did have one question I wanted to ask before we started to talk about hedging, and that was about the gold and silver swap. We have somebody from Texas asking they had swapped out of a combination of gold and silver into gold last April, and it was a point in which we were both very aggressively recommending people do that, and they want to know whether they should go back now that the gold silver ratio has touched 57, and I know 57 has been your point at which I think you were recommending to swap. So what about that? Is now a time to swap or not?
Well, let me ask that question another way. Let's say that they swapped out of silver when 35 ounces of silver bought an ounce of gold. Today, say 56 ounces, an ounce of gold will buy 56 ounces of silver. So if they swap back, they'll have 71% more ounces of silver than they began with.
Right.
Is that a good trade? Well, it would be if we're in Tennessee where I live. That's a great trade.
It'd be a great trade if they're willing to live through the volatility over the next 2 years. Because, you know, my expectation is that silver will, over the long run, produce a better return, but it could be much more volatile. So.
Right. But, you know, the edge of that problem has sort of worn off on me. Because I've got too many customers who've made everywhere from 10% to 60-70% gains on those swaps. I can put up with a lot of volatility for the opportunity to do that.
Okay, so let's talk about hedging now. And I just want to say we've gotten a series of questions over the last 6 weeks, and I really appreciate both Franklin and I'll bring him in after Franklin talks about futures, being willing to address the subject, because it's not a simple or clear subject. There are a lot of options, and all of them have pros and cons and challenges to them. But Franklin is first going to address the using future options, and then I'm going to bring Chuck in to talk about some of the securities. So, Franklin?
Okay.
Hedging.
Well, first thing you have to think about is that a hedge means that you're willing to forego gain in order to reduce risk. Because hedging has a cost, right? And not only does it have a cost, but it also tends to limit your gain, or it can limit your gain in some ways that it's done. The best way to hedge is to get somebody to pay you to hedge. In other words, they pay you to hedge. The only way I know to do that is what's called writing covered call options. What that means is that you sell call options. For instance, a call option on silver futures. Let's say that you had 10,000 ounces of silver that you wanted to hedge, and you could sell options to buy silver if the price falls under, or reaches some number where you would say, well, I got a big profit on it, I'd just as soon get out there. Or you could, and people will pay you for those calls that you sell. The other way to do it is to buy put options, which gives you the right to buy or to sell silver futures at a certain price. In other words, let's say you look at silver and you say, if silver goes under $26, I don't want to be, I want to sell my position. So what you would do is you would buy these put options, which gives you the right to sell or to put it to the other person at $26. And that way, you know, you're covered. The thing about an option is that there's a huge amount of leverage in an option. So you don't have to buy too many options to cover a fairly large position. The bad thing about options is, as all those people who sell options know, is that most of them expire worthless. So most of them are never exercised. But, you know, if you don't mind reducing your gain by the amount you pay for the option, that it's really the best way to go. And it's the only way I like to speculate on a market. If I think the market's going to rise, but if I didn't have enough money to buy the silver or gold, you can buy the options, and I would buy in the money options, and that would hedge the fact that you don't have enough money to buy them. The thing about options is you pay for the option, and the total risk is the cost of the option. If the option expires worthless, you lose everything. If the option expires with some value, then you win. But these are not options on metal. They're options on metal futures. That's another thing that you need to think about. The difference between options and futures is, with futures, you have to put up a certain margin, that is a certain percentage of the value. And the bad thing about that is, as the market rises, the market managers, like the COMEX, change the margin requirements. They raise the margin requirements when the market rises very quickly, and they lower the market requirements when it falls, for much the same reasons that Onata announced that they weren't going to trade this weekend. In other words, they want to slow off trading in these hot markets. They don't want to handle huge volumes, and those higher margins will close people out. I don't like futures because the losses with futures can be huge. Market moves fast. You get closed out of it. It opens limit down 2 or 3 days. You're long whatever the commodity is, and the next thing you know, you're presented with a $100,000 loss, and you never even had an opportunity to do anything. I don't like that kind of operation. I want to know what my risks are, and I want to limit my risks, and that's the reason I like futures options, because they will work. You know? But again, you've got to figure that your gain will be reduced by the cost of the option. A number of years ago, in the gold and silver business, almost everybody operates this way. Not almost everybody, but all the big wholesalers operate this way. If they sell you, if I call somebody up and say, I want to buy 10,000 ounces of silver, and they sell me this 10,000 ounces of silver and we fix the price, they immediately turn around and at the same price, they buy futures contracts for 10,000 ounces of silver. And what that means is they're not long silver, they're not short silver, because they bought 10,000, they sold 10,000, so they got a flat position. And what they're trying to do is only make the spread between buy and sell, that is the spread they buy at versus the sell they spread at, on whatever this item is, if it's 90% coin or bars or 1 ounce rounds, whatever. So they hedge. And I've tried hedging, but in a bull market, you will very seldom on a day-to-day basis be caught in a very bad downward move. So you actually make more money by not hedging than hedging. And that holds true even more strongly for a person who has a long-term position. And I understand, you know, that when we talk academically about how much money you can make and opportunity cost and all that sort of stuff, it's very easy to talk about the profits you might have generated if you jumped in and out of the market and all that other stuff. Well, in my book, you know, a lot of that's hogwash because you can't trade that well. You know, you can trade that well when you're looking backwards through the rearview mirror, but you can't trade that well when you're driving forward. And so if you've got a long-term position, your strategy is ride the primary trend. And it does. It's a very, very poor practice to change that strategy, your main strategy, in the middle of an investment. So, in other words, if you bought the stuff for a long term investment to ride the primary trend that runs 15 or 20 years, you don't want to start trying to jump in and out and catch the little bitty waves, you know, the little fluctuation waves on that big long wave. So that's pretty much everything I know about hedging.
Okay, well, thank you. Well, now it's my pleasure to introduce you to somebody that I've wanted to introduce you to for a long time, and I'm introducing them to the subscribers at the same time, and that is my partner, Chuck Gibson from California, and I just want to tell a story on Chuck. He's one of the reasons we get along so well is he's an engineer by training, and he thinks very, very logically about everything. He's, in fact, Franklin, you love it. He's always saying to me, what if we're wrong? What if we're wrong? So he's always trying to come up with a scenario that we haven't thought of. But the way I met Chuck, I had an investment advisory client call me, and they were committed to finding somebody in their local area in California, in San Francisco Bay Area. And so they did a very careful person, and they did a search. They got all the names from the Department of Corporations, and then they went and interviewed 13 people and came back to me and said, you know, the only one I like is this one guy. Would you check him out? And that was in 2008. And to make a long story short, we're partners today in Sea Lane Advisory. So Chuck is coming to us from Pleasanton, California. Chuck, are you with us?
I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. I should also mention that Chuck is managing member of Financial Perspectives, which is his investment advisory firm in Pleasanton as well. So Chuck, Franklin's just covered options, as you've heard, future options. But, of course, a lot of people want to do their hedging through a brokerage account. So if I'm going to use securities, what are my options for hedging gold and silver?
Well, first off, I'd just like to say that it's a pleasure to be here with you, and also to extend my introduction to Franklin. I've always I've yet to had a chance to talk to him, and I really look forward to it. But you know, Franklin covered so much of what I was going to say. The one thing though that we didn't talk about was if you were not going to, you know, in a brokerage account, you have basically two investment types that you can do. You can either do options on the underlying paper security, or you can use exchange-traded funds and or mutual funds that move inversely to the underlying metal price. Now, let's, you know, Frank could cover the options really well. Maybe what we could talk about is the other thing, which are the exchange-traded funds and mutual funds.
Okay, let me just play devil's advocate here,
because
sure. Some of us are not. The redundancy is good, Chuck, so I would love it if you would cover the options again.
Sure. No, I will, okay. But let's cover the easy thing first. Options are so
okay.
Complicated, and so let's cover the easy thing, which people are going to, you know, first off, options, you have to be approved by your broker-dealer to even use them in many cases, so they may not be available to everybody that, you know, is listening. So the one thing that is available to everybody are those exchange-traded funds and mutual funds that move inversely to the metals themselves. So you have available to you non-leveraged and leveraged funds. And when I say non-leveraged, they intend to move exactly opposite one-to-one price movement. So if the price of gold moves up $1, this, or let's call it a percent, moves up 1%, then this mutual fund or exchange-traded fund will move down 1%. So those are available to you, and the problem is that they use paper, as, you know, most of them use futures contracts, and those futures contracts expire. And so what ends up happening is that they're not perfectly correlated. So, for example, gold, over time, gold may go up 1%, and your hedge may move down more than 1% or may move down less than 1%. So it's not a perfect correlation. And while that's not such a bad thing, people have to understand that before they, you know, get into an investment so they know what they're getting themselves into. So what you can do, the bad thing about them is this, is that if you want to have a one-to-one hedge, if you've got $100,000 in gold or precious metals of some sort, you've got to have the same amount of money sitting in cash that you can put into another security as your hedge, unless you're going to do a partial hedge. So most people I know don't sit around with that much cash sitting, you know, available and not being utilized or invested. So that's what makes these investments less than attractive. Now, there are leveraged versions of them, and I highly would recommend people not use them because of the decay that is constant in them. The longer you hold them, the less correlated they become to the actual investments themselves. So, but what we all have to realize is that these are all paper investments, and like all paper investments, and if stuff really gets bad out there, like a 2008 type of event, you're really dependent upon the other person, the counterparty on that trade, to fulfill their bargain if and when you're ready to sell.
Right.
It's not like holding a piece of metal. Once it's yours, and you know nobody can take it away from you. But on a piece of paper, you're still reliant on the person, you know, who is the counterparty of your trade to make sure that they follow through. So, you know, again, it's just a concern that one has to be worried about. So, you know, really that's what there is in brokerage accounts, and I'm not going to go into the specifics of, you know, which ones to recommend or what vehicles you can use, but there are those investments that move also, I mean, they're just focused just specifically on inverse correlation to gold, and then there are those that move inversely to silver. And they're all familiar. The good thing about them is that usually they're very liquid. There's a high number of, you know, people trading on them, so you're not going to have to be concerned about if and when you're ready to sell, that make sure that there's somebody on the other party, you know, on the other side of the trade to be able to liquidate for.
Right.
Now, that's really the simple side of the brokerage accounts, and then you get into options. And Franklin did a really good job of covering what I was going to say. So before I step in there, I would like to say this, though, is that I think – what he said needs repeating, which is something I learned a long time ago, and I'm not specifically talking about gold and silver. I'm talking about anything that is in a long-term primary bullish trend. The best thing you can do is to leave it alone. Don't hedge, because any hedge, unless you're perfect, unless you're really smart or unless you're really lucky, is a way to separate you and your money. And I just find that really, really difficult. I've learned from firsthand experience that hedging in a bull market really makes no sense at all. So I would caution people to do that, because not only is it you have to be perfect in your timing of getting in and getting out, but you also have to worry about the costs that are associated with it.
Right.
So now we throw out all the negatives. Let's talk about options. The beautiful thing about options is that they're highly leveraged. They're 100 to 1. So if you wanted to leverage $100,000 worth of precious metals, you really don't have to have, you know, as much money. You can have a few – or put it this way, you have the ability to hedge a large position with a smaller amount of cash that you have to put up as your hedge. But, you know, if I were to do this myself, what I would recommend is that you take a fixed portion of your assets. So let's say you have 100,000 in precious metals. You take no more than 1 to 2% of that and use it as an insurance policy. And you specify some period of time, and I'm going to spend that for 1 year. I'm going to spend no more than 1 to 2% of my portfolio of that position and use that to buy a hedge, and options are the best way, because that 1 to 2% will buy you a lot of insurance. Think of it as a, again, I'm not advocating this, but think of it as a life insurance policy. You know, hopefully you don't die, but if you do, it's good, and it, you know, it allows you to capture some money from the fact that you've died, but hopefully it will never happen, and the odds of it happening are really, really low.
Right. So I remember April 2011 when a lot of us swapped from silver to gold. If for some reason you didn't want to do that, and, you know, obviously silver, when it touched 50, was at a remarkable place relative to the moving averages on its chart. I mean, that's the kind of – that's the time you might consider doing something like that.
Excuse me.
Was that Franklin?
Yes. I was just going to say that actually doing the swap does hedge your silver investment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It does more than that, actually. It takes a big profit out of your silver investments, although it's a two-step process, it takes a big profit out of the silver investment to hedge any potential loss.
Yeah.
So if silver goes down 25%, but you have 70% more ounces than you began with, well, everything's okay.
Yeah.
You haven't lost.
Absolutely. One of the things I wanted to bring up in terms of options, if you look at the different securities that, that different people invest to invest in gold and silver, there may not be options on their particular security or their particular fund. So is it possible to use options on things that have much more liquidity in the market?
Yes, and that was what I would recommend, because options, you think stocks are thinly traded, options are even more thinly traded, and it becomes the spread between the bid and the ask is something that one has to watch, because if you're giving away, you know, 5% of the money that you're spending up front just to trade that, to give it to the money makers or the market makers, then, you know, you have to find something that's a little bit more liquid. It just doesn't pay off, especially, again, when you're in a long-term bull market. You want to find, if you're going to do this, you want to do it where the spread is as thin, you know, as small as it can possibly be, and you also want to do it on the most volatile investment. So if you're looking at both gold and silver, you know, for me, what I would do is I would approach it from silver, because I would expect to see, and use 2008 as an example, gold lost 20-something percent from its peak to its, you know, trough, and silver lost almost double that. So if
right.
you're going to hedge something, you want to hedge the more volatile investment.
Right. I want to ask both of you now, what do you expect for the rest of the year? Chuck and I, Franklin, talk a lot about volatility. And I would love to get your take, both of your takes, on how, what you think the volatility, what kind of volatility are we looking for the rest of the year, particularly with some of the things that we've been talking about, including the Greek elections this weekend. Franklin, why don't you start?
Well, you know, I think that we're being set up for more volatility because the expectations are rising that, you know, I heard on National Proletarian Radio this morning the commentator claiming that the drop in the real estate was over and, you know, it was the beginning of the new dawn in real estate. And I think that and expectations, which are born a lot of them out of politics, that the economy is about to recover and that the worst is over, sets us up for another fall. And then when people say, wait, I thought the dawn was coming up and I see that we've got a total eclipse of the sun, then they panic and they tend to panic, you know, out. And there are all sorts of situations in Europe, you know, Spain, Portugal, Italy, France, for heaven's sake, that could blow up at any time. And all that increases volatility in the market. It also, volatility is also increased by the actions of people like Bernanke, who swing like, you know, the pendulum in a gigantic county courthouse clock from one side to the other, mashing down the monetary accelerator and hitting the brakes. So I think that more volatility is just baked into the whole situation. I don't see how that can be avoided. But I think the volatility will push gold and silver higher faster because we're in the second stage of a bull market where time is compressed and price rises faster.
Chuck?
I agree with him. I think, though, that, you know, while we're going to have more volatility, I think there is maybe a floor that is going to be, you know, supporting prices, if you will, from the nice government men or the nice central bankers around the world who are going to do whatever they can to keep things as reasonably stable as they possibly can, and especially during the election year, our election year. And, you know, so I'm looking at the balance of 2012 being quite volatile, but I think that the downside is limited. I'm not saying it doesn't have more down from where it's at, but I think the downside is limited. What I'm really afraid of is into 2013.
Right. You found, you did a chart for us that was remarkable, and it showed the the tracking of the S&P versus the QE1, then the QE2, and then Operation Twist. And
yep.
It really clarified how much this market is trading off of central bank policy. And I say that because we're coming up to a Fed meeting on June 20th, and Operation Twist runs out at the end of the month. Any thoughts on what you think they might do?
Well, I personally think that they're going to keep things. I don't think that they're going to do anything that could influence the direction of the election, and that's why I think that 2012. But I do, at least overtly, I think covertly, they will do whatever it be, whether extend. I think they will do an extension of, Operation Twist of some form or another, but an outright QE, I think, is off the table, at least until the election is over, or unless we have, a complete waterfall event that's caused because of something external to the United States. I think, 2008 was an internal event. I think 2012 or the next one will be caused from an external, either most likely Europe or, the Middle East. And so I definitely think that they're going to keep things as low-key as they possibly can, but knowing that they have to do something because this thing, we're very, very close to a, and it depends on who, what you want to call a recession. We're very, very close to a global recession. And the only country that's actually doing reasonably well is, if you look at the numbers, is the United States. Everybody else is, Europe's already in a recession, and look at China. There's all kinds of slowdown warnings out there. And when you look at the slowdowns, that tends to equate to slower growth, and slower growth equates to slower revenues, which equates to slower prices, profitability, and therefore lower prices in the markets. And so to me, this is a time to be very, very cautious. And the other thing I think it's worthy of mentioning is the fact that, the markets as we know them are really not something that is, for the average person, they're really not the markets, because right now 80% of the trades are done via either high-speed computers that hold these positions for less than a second, or they're done by institutions. So they're directing whatever direction the market is going with their underlying purchases, and only somebody, not me, knows which way they want it to go. And that's what scares me probably the most, because if all of them, switch the sell order on all at once or the buy order on at once, we start to see these ridiculous, movements in the market that Franklin was talking about. It just makes no sense. 1 minute they're down 1%, and then you flip a switch, and then the next minute they're up 1%. It's crazy.
Right. That's also an argument for sticking with the primary trend.
Oh, absolutely.
And letting the skittish swing back and forth while we just align with the primary trend and stick with it. Franklin, did you want to add anything?
Well, I just want to point out, I think you're right, that they want stability. They're always working for stability, and they're aware that if they put too much money out in the market, they can blow things up. But also, I look at the astonishing moves that have been made since 2007, 2008. Bernanke, the Swiss and the ECB just basically opened up the whole world, opened up to the dollar window to the entire world when they just said, we'll offer unlimited swaps if you need dollars. Will offer unlimited dollar swaps. That, together with trillion-dollar increases in these central bank balance sheets, and Bernanke, put out $16 trillion during the 2008 crisis to loan that much to various banks. Well, that money goes somewhere, and if they get into a there's no question, when they get into a crisis, they have only two solutions. One is Blarney, and the other one is inflation. And they'll put the president, the head of the central bank, all the rest of those people on the TV to blather that everything's okay, try to calm the panic. And then the second thing that they'll do is they will flood the market with liquidity. So, I mean, I'm just emphasizing what you just said, that it will be if they are panicked, they will flood the market with liquidity. flooded.
Right.
I don't think they have to be panicked. I think they're going to flood the markets with liquidity because that's what they need to. But the bottom line is that at some point in time, that's all of that is going to come home to roost, and that's what I'm most afraid of. You can't do that forever without having some ramifications. You know, you've got the fire hose in your mouth, and they turn it on the spigot. You can only hold so much in your belly before it starts coming out of your nose and your ears.
Well, I just want to mention one thing on politics, because we've gone from a situation where it was almost inconceivable to imagine that the sitting president couldn't win, to the Republican ticket, despite many, many flaws, looking a lot more serious. And part of that is there are lots of little hints coming out of the Bilderberger meeting that there is a real interest in what I would call a radical reengineering of the federal budget. And the one thing I would say is I agree with both of you that they're going to print, but if they really are working towards a radical reengineering, and it's too early to tell for sure, but if that turns out to be a serious consideration, and it's one that would be much more supportive of the Republicans than the Democrats, but if they really do take that on, then it always pays to sort of inflict plenty of financial terror to make it a lot more feasible to do.
Could you briefly describe what you mean by radical reengineering?
Yeah, you saw the head of PIMCO, who took he left PIMCO for a while to run Harvard Endowment and then came back. And I would point to both Romney and Obama, I think, of as Harvard Endowment candidates. They come out of the same place. But you see him talking about how you need real structural change in the government budget and government investment, and how we do housing and how we do transportation and how we do all these different things. And if you look at what's been happening in terms of bringing down the natural gas price, making manufacturing more competitive, and what technology could do to reengineer the federal government, the federal budget itself, remember, Romney is Larry the Liquidator. He's the guy who comes in and strips, fires everybody, and reengineers everything. So if you wanted wealth, but think about it, a dollar goes all the way up to Washington in taxes and then comes down in an unbelievably paperful, labor-intensive process from federal, state, to local government. If you wanted to reengineer that in the way that corporate operations had been engineered, you could do, I took over FHA in 1989. We had 7,000 employees. I sat down and did a back of the envelope and realized, I could run the whole place with 250 people if I could use technology. So if they decide they want to do a radical reengineering of how government policy and investment works, that could be remarkably deflationary. So that could cut into the printing. But to do that, they need to inflict financial terror. And I think, but I'm with you, it's really a matter of how much you scare people before you print like crazy. Okay, well, gentlemen, our time is up. Before we finish, anything else?
Yeah, I just said nothing for me.
Okay, well, I just wanted to mention you do blog, and if people want to keep up with your work, we know everybody knows the Money Changer, but could you mention your blog and how we can find you on the internet?
Sure. It's www.financialperspectives.biz, and go to the Perspectives page, and you'll see it there.
Okay. And I should mention I republish a lot of the Financial Perspective blog posts. They're great. Franklin, thank you very much. Where are you going to be next month?
Well, I don't know. My wife is having heart surgery here sometime soon, and her second heart surgery, as a matter of fact. So I'm liable to be in intensive care up there, not myself, but with her. So,
may I have your permission to invite prayers for Susan?
Oh, certainly. Absolutely.
Okay.
Please.
Susan Sanders, please keep her, lift her up in your prayers. Okay, that's it for Precious Metals Market Report this month. Coming up next week, we have John Rappaport, Best Books for the 21st Century. John and I decide how to get it down to 5 books, so we're going to do a part 1 and part 2. So next week will be part 1. And then we'll be back in the first week of July with a very exciting Solari report we're going to have the editor of Make magazine, and we're going to be talking about the Maker movement, which is people getting together all over the country and creating shops and garages and learning how to make everything themselves. It's quite inspiring, and I think it's part of, you know, the development of what technology now permits us to do. And then, of course, we'll be back the following week for the Precious Metals Report with Franklin. So until next week with John Rappaport, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Good night and good luck.